It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
On this episode of First Lady and Friends, I had a great conversation with Emily Aumann. She's a mom. She is a mom of a child that has an intellectual disability, and he has participated in unified sports with the Special Olympics. Her experience is powerful as a parent, and it was fun to listen to her share with us today. Let's get proximate. Welcome back to First Lady and Friends. On this episode, I have an incredible person that I just met. Her name is Emily Aumann, but we have a love of Special Olympics unified sports together. But the unique thing is that she is a mom of one of the athletes. So welcome to the program, Emily. So happy to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited. You and I had an experience at Brighton High School a few weeks ago. And we'll get into that. And I want to deep dive into your experience as a parent. But let's first talk about you. Tell me about where you grew up. Tell me a little bit about your family, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, yeah. So I grew up mostly in Utah. I was born in Cache Valley, and we moved around a bit as my dad rejoined the Army. And so when I was 7, we ended up back in Cache Valley, and I went to school there and got to enjoy the small town life there. I was the youngest of 6 kids, and then we had 2 bonus kids when I was a little bit older. So I'm exactly the middle child, even though there's 8 of us, but by age I'm the middle, and we're still, now my family is all over the United States, but we still get together. And yeah, I went to school at Utah State University.
Go Aggies.
That's right. And I met my husband there, and we were married, and we had our first child 5 days after we graduated.
Oh, wow.
So I got started right into motherhood as soon as I graduated. We came to Salt Lake City when my daughter was just under 1, and we've been here most of the time there. We got to spend 2 years living abroad for my husband's work. We went to England, and we got to take our kids, and then we've been back. We're in Sandy now, and I have 4 children. My youngest has a unique genetic mutation. It's called Kleefstra syndrome. And so he was born with this mutation. And at about 9 months old, we figured out that there was something going on, something different about him. And maybe we'll talk about that some more. But eventually, he's diagnosed with Kleefstra syndrome and autism spectrum disorder. And it's been a really unexpected journey, but he has been one of the greatest teachers. Mm-hmm. In my life and in our family. And it's been really a huge growing experience to be his mother.
Mm. Tell me a little bit about your experience in England. What was that like with little kids? And were you right in London? Where were you at?
We were about an hour east of London, a place called Colchester. I'm in East Anglia, where it does not rain all the time. We were expecting it to rain all the time, but actually that's the sunny side of England. We had a really wonderful experience as we were considering moving there. Everett was 2 years old, and our biggest concern was whether or not they would have the resources that we needed. We found that they did. We decided to go for it, and we had a really incredible opportunity there where they included him in the, it's called a village school. And so he got to go to the mainstream school and be a part of the community there. And it was really neat. I would tell people that picking Everett up from school was like being with a celebrity. That, you know, everybody, every kid, all of the adults are, hi, Everett. Hey, Everett. High five, Everett. And it was really, really amazing to see him be included and to see him be a part of something bigger and to have that sense of belonging. While the resources there are very different than they are here, I wouldn't say that they are less or more. We had a wonderful experience, and he had really amazing opportunities there. And when we came back, we were able to jump back into the things here, and we've had a great experience with the special education in Canyon School District. They've been wonderful, all the teachers that we've had there. And then we were really excited when he was 8 years old. He qualified to be part of the Special Olympics. He could participate in sports. And with him, we've always tried to get him involved in whatever way we could. When he was first diagnosed, he was pretty distant. Like, as a baby, he was a really easy baby. At one point, I went on a 13-hour road trip with my four children, just myself and my four children. And he was like 1 year old at the time. And he was a dream the whole way. Like, he was absolutely amazing. And I was like, wow, this is the best kid ever. Like, what a gift this fourth child is. And then, you know, as we started getting diagnoses, we realized that he was distant for a different reason, that he was experiencing the world very differently than how we experience it. And when he was first diagnosed, it was really hard, and we didn't know what the future was going to hold for him. When you get a diagnosis like that, it's like the dreams that you had for your child that you didn't understand were there. You didn't know that you had these dreams for your child, but they're all washed away. And as soon as they wash away, you realize that they were there.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point. I want to make sure that we don't just skip over this, because, my background in special education, I got kids that came to school, and, I'd watch parents drop them off. And I remember getting to the end of the school day and thinking, I am exhausted, but I'm sending this child home. And I'm sending these kids home, and I'm not doing dinner and bedtime and day in and day out and every, waking moment thinking and worrying about this child and all the things that go with it. So I want to talk really specifically about that moment and sort of the process mentally, physically, spiritually that you have to go through, or you did go through. I mean, there's sort of a grieving process, I would assume, of expectations, not grieving that you're, I mean, it's just, I don't know. Maybe you should explain it.
Okay,
talk about it. Yeah.
You are spot on there. Absolutely is a time of grieving. And with my son's diagnosis of Kleefstra syndrome, we have a Facebook group. And
will you just explain that syndrome and just maybe talk about, I've not heard of it. I think most of the listeners probably haven't heard of it. It's obviously in the category of rare diseases. So talk a little bit about what it is and sort of how it manifests.
So Kleefstra syndrome is a genetic deletion on the ninth chromosome. So the end of the ninth chromosome is missing or mutated. In Utah, when your child has some sort of is delayed, mm-hmm. you can just call. In fact, anywhere in the United States, you can call a hotline. I think it's like baby or baby, something like that. And they will send people to your home to do testing, and it's free and it's very quick. And that's kind of the first step. Like, we had talked to the doctors about it, and we'd wondered about him missing milestones, being able to hold his head up or being able to sit up and things that we would be expecting him to do. A lack of eye contact. Mm-hmm. At one point, I mean, Kids are great, and all kids are different, and there was definitely interaction, and he was acknowledging that we were there, but there were moments that he wouldn't, he would just kind of check out. Mm-hmm. And I had mentioned to my husband, maybe we need to get this checked out, and he's like, no, I don't know if this is a thing. And then he came home from work one day, and Everett was laying on the ground outside, and he said, and he looks at me, and he's like, watch this, and he walks up kind of behind him, and he's like, Everett, and there was zero response. Mm-hmm. And that was when it was like, okay, yeah, there's something going on. We need to get this checked out. And so we called this line, and the early intervention specialist came to our home. I think it was the next week, and they go through this series of testing. I believe there's There's like 7 tests or 9 tests, and he scored basically 0 on most of them. Mm. And I thought that I was ready for that. I thought that I knew, like, okay, there's something going on, and I had accepted that there was something going on. But in that moment, it was like that wave just washed away everything that I thought was going to be his life. And it was really hard for me. I didn't know how to talk about it. I didn't know. All I knew is that he was developmentally delayed. At a global developmental delay. So it's not something you can Google, like you're not going to get a lot of information. And as a parent, you naturally just learn from other parents and kind of get an idea of what's going on and what to expect. But as soon as your kid has something like this, and it's like, oh, you have zero experience, you have zero modeling for it. And it just felt so foreign, so out of reach, and that I couldn't, I didn't have a way to understand what was happening. I didn't know how to help him. And then I really began to have this fear that I wouldn't be able to love him. And I don't think everybody would have this. Like, for whatever reason, like, that was my thing, was like, am I going to be able to love him well enough? Like, if he can't do anything, if he can't do stuff, you know, and I don't know exactly where that came from, but this was very real for me. And there was just a few weeks there that I just kind of checked out of life and just kind of stayed at home and tried to kind of process what was going on, tried to Google stuff and look stuff up and figure out how I was going to handle this. And there was this really specific moment that I was in the backyard just holding him, and he was really floppy and but also really smiley and had sparkly eyes, and I'm holding him and I just sent up this prayer, like what am I going to do? And in that moment, my heart just opened and I got this answer that he was exactly who he needed to be, and that he had a purpose here, and that he was going to shine. And there's kind of little, I can't describe it exactly in words. I think our heart speaks to us without words sometimes, but in that moment, I knew it was going to be okay. Honestly, there was also this little bit of, he's going to cause a lot less heartache than any of your other children. That was part of that message, because kids, they have a lot of life and a lot of opportunity before them. And there's going to be hard things. No matter what your kid has, there will be hard things. And so I don't want anyone to think that this is some sort of exception or different, you know, exceptionally different than other children. Because it's the same, but it's a different kind of same. When he was about 1 year's, okay, actually on his first birthday, I'm just going to go into some random stories here.
No, you're
on
good.
On his first birthday, we went on, my husband and I were asked to go on trek with the local, church congregation. And we left him on his first birthday, which was kind of rough, right? And we decided to bring a birthday candle with us, and so we're having cornbread in the fields of Wyoming, and we're like, hey, you know, it's our son's birthday, it's his first birthday, so we're gonna do this candle. And this kid walks over, and he clearly has autism, and he was from a different family, and he walks over, and our kids, you know, our pretend kids, were so warm and welcoming to him. They knew his name. They were not condescending in any way. They were his friend, and they were excited to see him, and they were joking with him and having a good time with him. And then we sang happy birthday, and we were like, oh, well, who's going to blow out the candle? And he said, well, I will. Of course you will. Like that. Yeah. It was just a really kind of special message that, and just that moment of seeing there is a place for our son. And that place is made by the people around him. And as our youth and as all the people around us are opening up that space and accepting people for exactly who they are, there will always be a place for him.
Oh, that is so beautiful. Okay, I want to continue talking about this and the way that we connect over Special Olympics, and we'll do that when we come right back.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was 3 blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
We're back here on First Lady and Friends with Emily Aumann. She's a mom, and she is lots of other amazing things as well. And but we connected through Special Olympics, Unified Sports, and through our team. But I want to continue on this conversation about, you know, sort of our expectations for our kids and how they change. We were talking during the break about a book that I've mentioned on this podcast before, Love That Boy, and just our parental expectations. We all have to reevaluate at times what we expect for our kids and how those things change based on what we learn. So talk a little bit more maybe about how you navigated through the changing expectations after his diagnosis, after Everett was diagnosed.
Yeah, that's definitely something that was, in a way, it was on my mind from the beginning. And I think that, as I mentioned, that I just had this fear like I wouldn't be able to love him. And I think that was coming from like these expectations that I had that we perform, and because we perform, we become something. And that's where our value comes from. Mm-hmm. And that I was... in that somehow I had adapted this way of thinking that was what we do determines how valuable we are. Mm-hmm. And that has been just completely turned on its head by him. Was something I wrote about with him is that, you know, as you watch him try to learn things, and he's learning these things that take all of this intervention, right? We had early intervention specialists coming into our home. Eventually we had other types of therapists. We had occupational therapy. We had speech therapy. We had applied behavioral analysis therapy. And so we have all of these professionals working with him to try to get him to learn the things that came so naturally, the things that I didn't even realize my other children had been learning as they were going. And it just really started to open up this idea that, like, people are amazing. We are amazing. And who am I to ever judge my kid and be like, oh, like... like, I don't know how your grades are there. You know, like, you could maybe do a little better when, like, it should be. Like, when you have a kid like this, like, everything turns into, like, wow, like, you were able to get on the bus by yourself today? That's incredible. Like, think of how amazing you are and all the amazing things you do.
And how long it took to get to that moment, you know, all the work that it took to get to those little moments that we, most of us, and for your other kids, that we take for granted.
Yeah.
That those things are going to happen, like you said. So I love the idea that, you know, you're figuring this out and appreciating those moments.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of expectations, also you have to change your kind of your daily expectations of, like, how are vacations going to go, mm-hmm. and how, you know, what's dinner time going to look like? And like, how we're going to spend time as a family. Another experience I had, we were on this hike. My son was about, I think he was probably about 18 months old. And so it's still kind of new that he has this disability, but we had gotten into this incredible program. It's called Floor Time, Play to Learn. And we had been learning from this teacher about how to meet your child exactly where they are and to connect by letting them lead and by creating moments of joy together that just, like, just connecting. And so we were on this hike. It was a really simple hike down in Canyonlands. We were with another family, and it was supposed to be just a simple, easy, everyday thing to do. And he had developed this obsession, as kids with autism can do, of drawing giraffes. And he actually was nonverbal until he was 6 years old, which is a story in itself that was really amazing to witness. But he had a way of communicating with people, and he's always had just this ability to connect with people that, while we say that he's disabled in another way, like, he is super abled in this way that we don't talk about, and that we don't have a way to measure, this way of the heart that he has in connecting with other people. And so he could, like, kind of sign, like, giraffe and kind of, you know, like, point at things and be like, please draw me a giraffe, essentially. And so it was really sandy, and he kept asking me to draw a giraffe, and he wanted to stop, and he's, like, whining and crying. He's, you know, in the carrier on my back. And I'm getting so frustrated. I'm like, I just want to go on a hike. This is a simple thing. I'm with my friends. I just want to go on a hike. Like, autism, don't take this away from me. So I'm thinking to myself, like, oh, why did we come on this vacation anyway? And then I had this aha moment of thinking about what I had learned in this class, that I had come to draw giraffes in the sand and to connect with my son. And so I stopped trying to catch up with the other people, and I let him down, and I got a stick, and we drew giraffes in the sand. And then we would walk 20 feet and draw a giraffe in the sand. And then we would walk backwards 20 feet and draw a giraffe in the sand. And so I've been able to adjust this expectation that maybe instead of going on a hike, like, we'll just go outside. We'll just find a beautiful place to be, to sit together, to enjoy nature, and to do what he wants to, and to follow his lead. Mm-hmm. And just the beauty that comes from following your child's lead instead of always trying to lead them.
Gosh, that's so incredible, and something, again, there's so many lessons that you learn painfully that we should all learn as parents, and I think that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Talk a little bit about, as he's grown in school. I've shared this before. I had a person who graduated from high school, you know, recently, and I was asking him about his experience. He had a physical disability, and he was telling me that, you know, I said, were you bullied? And I was talking about, you know, his experience. And he said, no, I wasn't bullied. People were friendly, but they weren't my friend. And there's a difference. And because he said that to me, I have not stopped thinking about it, and that what that means for all of our kids with all different abilities. And what it means to the difference between, of course, we want people to be friendly. Of course, we don't want them to be mean. But there's one step further. Are we being a friend to someone that needs us? So talk maybe just a little bit about Everett's experience as he's grown up with friends, and how he's made friendships, if he has.
Well, Everett has always been drawn more to adults than to children. Mm-hmm. And developmentally, he is still very behind. And so he hasn't had as much opportunity to be friends with peers. Mm-hmm. But the Special Olympics opportunity, that, like, that environment has provided that for him. Mm-hmm. And it is so amazing to watch these kids interact with each other. So in Special Olympics, you have your Special Olympic athlete, who is a person with a intellectual disability. And then you have a unified partner, which is a person without a disability that is competing alongside them. So Special Olympics is the most inclusive place that you can be.
It's so beautiful.
It is so beautiful. Sometimes with a child with a disability, you almost get like, they're like the most exclusive club is being a mother of a child with a disability. And sometimes it can be kind of frustrating, because it's like, well, my kid doesn't have that disability, but, like, I still want to be your friend. Like, can I be part of your club? You know, but Special Olympics is anybody that wants to be a part of this. Yeah. And it really is an amazing experience to go to these events, to go to practices, to go to the competitions, and to watch them love each other and just to be. The thing I feel about Everett is that he knows that he matters, and he knows that you matter. Mm-hmm. And then that's just how he exists. And it's just so, it is kind of, it's really hard to describe, right? Like, it's something that you feel, it's something you experience with your heart. So you just need to go to a Special Olympic competition, get involved with Special Olympics, and just see what this is like. The Special Olympics team that we're on right now, the Salt Lake Stars, we just started last year, and some Special Olympic athletes, and then we had some unified partners, and most of the unified partners are high schoolers. In fact, a lot of them were freshmen in high school. And then our coaches, some of our coaches are seniors in high school. And then we have a mom that when she was a collegiate dancer, and now she's a mom. And those are our coaches. And then we have these awesome high schoolers. And if you listen to them talk about it, they love it. They talk about how inclusive, how encouraging, how the friendship is just so natural there. And really, the only thing you need to do to matter there, to fit in, is to show up. And it's just like, there's nothing else like that. So it's been a really an amazing place for Everett to feel like he belongs and to have a place to shine and to be himself and exactly who he's meant to be. He can be pretty goofy and, you know, up on stage, he loves to give he's on a dance team right now, and he loves to try to do the splits. And he's a ham. He will get the audience in any way that he can. But he knows that he belongs and he knows that he matters. And as a mother, there's not really, you know, as we evaluate what we want for our children and reevaluate that. And that definitely came. What I want for my children is for them to feel like they belong. I don't need them to be the best at this or the best at that. I just want them to know that they belong and to have a chance to feel like they are capable and that they can work hard at something.
God, it's so true. You know, I've been really kind of thinking a lot about this idea of belonging the last little while. And I love that you talked about that. I noticed like during the pandemic, you know, it was such a unique and horrifically unique time, in the world, basically, to start to see some, I guess, behavioral experiments, if that's what we can call it. But I thought it's so interesting that the power of belonging was so strong. It's so powerful. It's so a part of our need structure as humans that we will find it in hate when we can't find it in love. And so I guess to me, I love your experience of seeing belonging in the most loving, inclusive place and the Everett's finding that belonging. And I think you're exactly right. I think as humans, if we can continue to have those types of experiences, if we can find belonging for everyone in healthy and loving places, then I think we can get rid of the hateful places. I don't think we need them anymore. I think we can all find that belonging and love, don't you think?
I absolutely agree with that. And in a way, I feel like that's part of the purpose of these people that have these, that are born with these differences than us. And part of the beauty of being together with people of all different abilities and whatever kind of difference it is that that these people specifically with the disabilities really can show us that it's about being together. Like, you matter because I'm with you. You matter because we're together, because we are here walking side by side in this same space, and you don't have to perform for anybody. You don't have to be a certain, look a certain way, have a certain ability, because, you know, all of those things are really, they're just our genes. Yeah. It's not really us. And, you know, we can think like we're so smart or we're so capable, we're so good at this. And yeah, we can put work into it and that's a beautiful thing too. But really, like, the only reason why we're able to do anything is because our genes are in the right place. And like that wasn't really our doing. So if we can just let go of waiting for somebody to be a certain something before you can love them and just love them.
Yeah. Oh, it's perfect. I want to continue this conversation and talk maybe next steps and what you see in the future. And we'll do that when we come right back. Okay, we're back here with Emily Aumann, and we are just talking all things Special Olympics at this point because we're both so enthralled with it, and that we just can't say enough good about the Special Olympics. I have to say that, you know, my just diving into the space, and of course I did special education is my background, so I was aware of Special Olympics. I really wasn't involved in Special Olympics until I started in this role and got more familiar. But I have to say, like, a few months ago, I was actually in Washington, D.C., and we were there for meetings, for National Governors Association meetings. But I just happened to we had a separate meeting with Tim Shriver, who's the chair of the Special Olympics, and I've met with him on a number of occasions, and he's actually there. His group Unite is going to be working with my husband and NGA initiative. But so it was kind of a separate meeting, and then he said to me at that meeting, he's like, come over and see our new place. So I actually had a few minutes and ran over to, they're in the Watergate building now, just so you know, Special Olympics in the Watergate building. And saw their new, they, you know, there were still boxes and everything. But it was really cool. He walked me through that space and talked to me about his mom, Eunice Shriver, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, who started the Special Olympics. And, you know, because her sister had an intellectual disability, and she just the origins of the Special Olympics are so beautiful. You know, just this, she didn't want her, you know, and at the time they were put away in institutions, people like that, people who, you know, these beautiful humans who have so much to teach us, like you say, were really being, you know, hidden away. And Eunice really was a pioneer in making sure that they had a voice. And so walking through with her son from seeing the pictures of all the Special Olympics games from the very beginning, it was just, it was so beautiful. And I can't tell you, I've talked many times about going to the USA games last June, but this June I'm headed to Berlin to the International Special Olympics games. And I'm so excited. I can hardly stand it. But I want you to talk about you've talked a little bit about your experiences. Talk about, you know, maybe the changes that you've seen in Everett as he's participated in the Special Olympics.
Well, Everett is actually not my only child that's involved with the Special Olympics. Both of his sisters also are with the Special Olympics. And so I would, if you don't mind, I'd love to talk about the
please.
Change I see
oh,
in
I would
all
love
of
that.
Them.
Yes.
For Everett, it felt like this battle to try to find a place for him to be involved with something. You know, school is not a place that he is highly successful. You know, he can go to school and not feel like he's super capable, right? Like he can, that's a place where he would notice where he's falling short of his peers. And so I wanted him to have something, somewhere to belong, something that he can be excited about, somewhere that he can find joy. Because I think that's one of the biggest things that we can teach our children is to I think that's what education is about, is to maximize their capacity for joy. So I wanted him to have these opportunities. And, you know, it took a lot of calling around, like, and trying to explain, like, this is what my son's like. Do you have a place for him? Could he participate at your neurotypical location of whatever it is? And in kindergarten, you generally can find places that are very accepting. And we had some wonderful experiences. But after that, the divide is too big, and the differences are just too great, and it's not a good fit anymore. And so as a mom, it just felt like I was going on this uphill battle. And then I was introduced to Special Olympics, and it was just this moment of, it already exists, it's here for us. Like, and then I got that chance to meet other mothers that have had these experiences, mothers of older children. You know, some of the athletes on Everett's team are adults now. And so I get to talk to them and get that insight and that camaraderie. So maybe I'm going to talk a little bit about what it does for me,
yes,
too.
Please.
That it's really amazing and lifting an inclusive place for the entire family. So we have Everett, that he has a place to belong. He has a place to shine and just to be who he's meant to be and to find joy. And then for his sisters, they have a place where they get to show up, that they don't have to perform. They don't have to be something else. And they're loved and they're accepted and they belong. And they get to know that they are making a difference, that they are contributing to the experience of these people that don't have as many experiences. One of the most incredible things we've gotten to do so far is BYU invited the Salt Lake Stars to dance at a halftime performance, which was just a once in a lifetime opportunity that three of my children got to dance in a college football game. And they,
wow.
Oh, the experience, the crowd, the people, the just like what that was for him was, and for all of them, was indescribable and such a high point. And, you know, I look back at myself sitting in the garden that one day, you know, wondering, like, what's his life going to be like? How are we going to do this? And then, and now it's like, already, he's only 8 years old. Already, he's had these amazing experiences, and he is shining, and he is touching people and touching people's hearts. He's lifting them up, and he's living his purpose. And to have a place where a child can do that, that, you know, a lot of doors are closed, and just naturally that happens. But to have this door open, and really, like, it's the greatest door that you can have, to have that place that you know that you matter.
Yeah, talk. I often tell the story, and I want you to tell it yourself, because I tell this story of the parent sitting in the audience. So you talked about, you know, him and your girls in front of a stadium. I mean, a college football stadium full of people cheering. Talk about, if you can, because I get emotional telling about it, and it's not even me, but talk about what that means as a parent, you know, given that diagnosis in that moment, and then fast forward those 7-ish years, when you're sitting in the stand at that ball game watching the entire place cheer for your child, what does that feel like?
It feels like everything you wanted being a parent to feel like. It feels like those dreams that I had of my child becoming something great were fulfilled. And they were great because they existed, because they're here, and they're great for the right reasons. Somehow Special Olympics, they, I don't know everything about their origins, but it sounds like it's a great beginning. They have captured all of the things that matter about competition. You know, I think it's a super appropriate name that it's the Olympics, because, you know, we watch the Olympics and we're so inspired by people. And when you watch the Special Olympics, it's the same thing, that you just are so inspired, and they've taken the pieces of competition that matter the very most in our hearts, and they have captured that. And I just would say to any parent out there that is recognizing that their child might have a diagnosis, might have something that's going to be hard for them, a challenge that that comes with a lot of unknowns, I would just say, don't fear. There's a place for your child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a beautiful life ahead for them.
Oh, that is so, so great, and I couldn't have said it better, and I appreciate those sentiments. That's exactly how I've thought a parent would feel, and you've articulated it so well, and I appreciate that, and I've seen that on the faces of parents in every event that we've done, and I've seen that in the hearts of the children that have succeeded in this way, and so I really appreciate your time and sharing with us these precious experiences. Thank you so much for being with us here today, Emily.
Well, thank you.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.